So what I'm going to be talking about today is some work done with Herman Berlinde, which appeared in these papers, and also, if I get to it, kind of ongoing stuff. And the basic idea is to look for a matrix model which is capable of describing 4D physics, or 4D quantum field theory, coupled to gravity. So I'm going to try and explain what I mean by roughly these words in the title. So the plan of the talk is, first I'll try to provide some motivation for the classic questions I'll be considering. Then I'll tell you what the matrix model is, and what some of its properties are. The checks we can do at this point, that it does describe something to do with 4D physics. And at this point, the checks that I'll talk about here consist of checking that the symmetries of the 4D theory are correctly reproduced, and also that some amplitudes, scattering amplitudes, are computed correctly by correlators of the matrix model. There's another check you can do, which I'm not going to talk about, which is related to reconstructing instantons in the 4D gauge theory from the details of the from data of the matrix model. But I won't talk about that here unless unless you ask me questions about it. And then conclusions and potential future directions. Okay. Okay, so the motivation for what I'm going to be talking about, I can't get over that, it's so cool. All right, so the motivation for what I'm going to be talking about is in the context of string theory, one of the main ideas in string theory is that it provides us with a way of thinking about quantum field theory coupled to gravity. Or at least that's what it's supposed to do. And so strings are supposed to provide us with a way of doing this. And at least in situations when we're talking about static spacetimes, what we have in mind is specifying, or the picture that usually is back in the back of the mind of many string theorists when they say this, is that you specify some background like this. And we imagine that this six manifold is small in order to describe 4D physics. Now, there's already a legitimate question you can ask about this kind of picture, which is kind of going to set up the classic questions I'm going to be asking here, which is, how realistic is this 10D picture, this classical 10D picture that we're writing down? And it's not completely clear. So if we just take a 4D physicist and we ask them, how much of these six-ish internal dimensions can you reconstruct? They start going up in energy scales, and they start to see some Kaluza-Klein modes. But at what energy scale do they actually see the full, smooth six manifold? They don't see it until they get up to the energy scale associated with Planck scale physics, at which point we're not talking about a classical geometry anymore. So unless you're willing to live with theories that have gravity decoupled in some limit, there's already a question about what we mean by this classical kind of geometry, and what we mean by getting out 4D field theories from some kind of compactification limit. So there's kind of just some qualitative expectations connected with where the geometry even comes from, emergent, and related to this, gravity. And I'm going to throw in also notions of holography. So along these lines, we might imagine, can we give some reason for, say, the entropy of, say, a black hole, scaling like an area law rather than like a volume law? Something related to De Sitter space, perhaps. And of course, in the context of string constructions, one might want to include examples like ADS-CFT. So one of the things one would like to know is, how do you track, for example, the degrees of freedom coming from quantum field theory? In other words, how does the quantum field theory either undercount or overcount the degrees of freedom once we start including gravity? So of course, that's a kind of a very general class of questions. And in the context of string theory, we have some potential avenues towards answering these. So for example, they all rest on basically using, I would say, here, some kind of large N set of degrees of freedom packaged inside of big matrices. So for example, the BFSS matrix theory conjecture of a way of describing limits of M theory provides us with one example. And ADS-CFT, you could say, provides one with a working definition of what you mean by quantum gravity in, say, ADS-5 times S-5 and related geometries. So given these examples, and you can also list other examples within string theory, and they all kind of seem to share the same feature of having some large end duality playing a privileged role. based on that, what I'm going to be looking for is a particular string theory. And in that string theory, I want to look for a large n dual for 40 UNC Super-Yang-Mills theory with n equals 4 supersymmetry, because that's everybody's favorite quantum field theory, plus gravity. asymptotically on R4. So that's going to be the aim. So again, the idea is to kind of try and get some handle on some aspects of how we might try to couple a 4D theory to gravity. And the way I'm going to try and approach it is by looking for a potential large end dual, kind of in the same vein as this. So in this context, what is the main ingredient from string theory that one uses? One can view it as a large number of D0 brains when studying the quantum mechanics of that system. In ADS-CFT, one's looking at a large number of D3 brains and studying the near horizon geometry of those D3 brains. What I'm going to explain to you is that this is the stringy origin of this guy is based on taking a collection of D6 brains wrapped on CP3, which I'll refer to as twister space. I don't want to go into too many details of twister space right now, but I'll get to some in a moment. Or more precisely, D3 brains wrapped on a supersymmetric version of CP3. And what we're going to be looking for is topological string theory here. And by considering a large n sector of this theory, what I'm going to do is try to bring out a large n dual for this system. So what I'll be trying to do is just tell you, first of all, what these ingredients have to do with each other, how the matrix model is defined, and then how we can actually check that it has something to do with 4D physics. Okay. Okay. So the proposal is as follows, that you can write down basically a UNC large N matrix model and as will hopefully become clear, this is going to be what I'll call a twister matrix model. It's going to be defined on a fuzzy or non-commutative version of twister space. The idea is that this fuzzy large N twister matrix model in the n goes to infinity limit will be describing for us the system we're describing there, where that refers to that bottom part, find the largest dual. And just some pieces of the matrix model dictionary that we can already state are, there's a coupling constant, G squared matrix model, and there's also down here, Yang-Mills coupling constant. These are related as a Tuft coupling. And the other relation is where the Planck scale comes from. We view the R4 as coming as a large radius limit of an S4. So I'm really talking about a Euclidean theory here. Take a large L limit of this, and the Planck scale comes out like this. So in other words, the radius is always parametrically bigger. The radius of the force here is always parametrically bigger than this. And by taking an appropriate limit, one is keeping this ratio fixed while taking n to infinity and l to infinity. Okay. Okay, so that's the proposal. So now let me explain where the proposal comes from and what it has to do with D6 brains wrapped on CP3 and all of that. Okay, so D6 brains wrapped on CP3/4. So by this, I really just mean six spatial directions. I'm forgetting about the temporal direction for here. So what's the stringy origin? For this system. So I'll describe it in kind of three layers. There's kind of the UV, the ADHM, and the IR. So the IR are things we're going to be computing, say, in the low energy theory. And those are going to consist of basically the analytic continuation of these matrix model correlators and what they have to do with amplitudes. The matrix model is going to sit here. And this theory of the D6 brains is going to sit here. Now, what is the theory on the D6 brains? It's going to be a theory which is actually figured in other attempts to connect 4D physics with twister space, known as holomorphic transignments theory. So what is this theory that I'm talking about here? So this is the same space as before. One can define it in the following way. So CP3/4 has homogeneous coordinates. We can label them as Z alpha, where alpha goes from 1 up to 4, and 4 coordinates psi I. Yes, and they're related by rescalings, where this is some number in numbers.
I goes 1 to 4?
Yeah. The reason it goes from 1 to 4 is because I put a 4 here. So anyway, it's counting the fermionic directions. Okay. The holomorphic transignments action that one writes down is, so first of all, some remarkable features of this space are that it's a Calabi-Yau supermanifold. And so as is common in other aspects of string theory, one can talk about a holomorphic form defined over this guy. And in this case, in fact, you can write down what this guy looks like. So there's an epsilon contraction with these guys. And then there's a 4 psi. And then the action is like so. It's basically a holomorphic version of the transignments action, as the name would suggest. This is a trace over the gauge indices. This is an integral over CP3/4. And this A here is a connection. It's a 0, 1. And this is a D bar up. OK, so this is kind of, from the perspective of the CP3/4 theory, this is kind of a boring theory, because, well, topological. I don't know if you call it boring. I consider it quite interesting. The link between 4D physics and this kind of weird-looking CP3/4 comes about in a couple of different ways. It depends on kind of what type of twister correspondence you're trying to set up. So related to twisters, there was a huge outgrowth of using this kind of theory and supplementing it with extra ingredients to try and construct a string theory for calculating scattering amplitudes. So one can try and use these amplitudes. But we can also use it for computing what instantons. Instantons would look like. And the basic link that one uses in the two cases is as follows. In the amplitude case, one basically splits the these coordinates, z alpha, up into two component spinners like this. And one has then a correspondence between points in the spacetime, in the Minkowski space, and then subspaces inside of this CP3. So this is a set of two equations. A is A dot and A are indices that run from 1 to 2. And this gives you a two linear equations inside of the CP3. This is identified with the corresponding CP1 that lives inside of the CP3. And one can extend this to the supersymmetric case. I won't bore you with the details. So that's kind of the amplitude use of this CP3/4. There's another use for it, which is in the context of instantons. And there, what you do is something slightly different. You view the CP3 as a collection of two spheres, or CP1s, fibered over S4. So this is more in gear with, say, a Euclidean twister spear. So in other words, doing something with writing down a theory on the CP3/4 tells you something about physics in the 4D spacetime. And the link is provided by these kinds of geometry. OK, so that's the kind of UV picture. We start with this kind of theory. So I should say that this kind of holomorphic Chern-Simons has been written down many, many times by many people. In the context of twister strings, it was written down or used extensively by Witten and also by Freddy earlier on. So what are the remaining pieces in these limits? So starting from this UV theory, what we're going to do is switch on a flux. We're going to switch on a background flux, so it's background choice of gauge field in this system. And the idea is that even though the original UV theory was kind of boring and it consisted of just topological degrees of freedom, by switching on the flux, what we're going to hope to find is extra low-energy ingredients coming in. And in the context of strings, we know that this kind of thing happens quite a bit. For example, if you take a brain and you switch on fluxes in it, you'll have the dynamic, you'll have instantons in the low-energy theory. So similarly, what we're going to be doing is looking for kind of the low-energy remnants of switching on this flux and expanding around that background. So really, this this matrix model should be thought of as the theory of a lowest Landau level. And I'll tell you how to think about this lowest Landau level in a second. OK, and then what I'm going to try and do is explain how you take ingredients from the matrix model and start to compute things like amplitudes. OK, so so just to recap, the idea is that we're going to be looking at taking a large N holomorphic Chern-Simons theory, switching on a background flux, studying the lowest Landau level, describe it in terms of a matrix model, and then computing things in the matrix model, try and extract useful quantities for 4D physics. And the basic link we're going to go between here, here, and here, between, in other words, the CP3 and the spacetime is going to be provided by this kind of picture.
So,
okay.
Sorry, what's the lowest Landau level?
So what I have in mind is suppose I give you like a quantum mechanics system and I switch on a background flux. Then I'm going to do that actually right
now. Okay.
So the idea with like a lowest Landau, if I switch on a background flux in quantum mechanics, then I have a picture in terms of the position coordinates or the momentum coordinates now becoming non-commutative. What we're going to be after is the theory of the lowest excitations around that background. So in other words, the lowest energy excitations, the lowest number. OK. So we switch on the flux, and we get Landau levels. So the picture to have in mind is that we have our holomorphic Chern-Simons theory, and we have the string ends. And they start to experience the background flux. So as a result of that, one gets a non-commutativity now of the coordinates z's, like this.
Does the flux break any additional supersymmetry?
Yeah. So what it will do. So I should tell you more about where the flux flux lives. The flux lives in. So before I answer your question on supersymmetry, I should tell you about the other places of what it breaks. The flux is contained. You can view it as being valued in the UN, contained in or the UN diagonal, contained in UN and C. And the flux we're going to be switching on is associated with the so-called Young monopole, and this has the nice property that it, for example, preserves an SO5 symmetry of the force sphere. It's an SO5 homogeneous instanton. And it's coming from basically taking an embedding of SU2 inside of, where one takes, say, the dimension n representation here and embeds it into the fundamental here. So this does initiate a breaking pattern in the symmetries. Now, to check what kind of symmetries are actually preserved by the by the system, what I'm going to do is just tell you the algebra obeyed by the Landau level. And what we're going to see is that one of the terms preserves an SL4/4 symmetry, which doesn't break anything. But there's another term which is basically only compatible with the symmetries of the supersphere, the S4/8. I don't know if that answers your question.
No.
Okay.
Say how many supersymmetries you have after you turn on the flux.
Well, so you started with a system that had four fermionic coordinates, and you still have those four fermionic coordinates playing a role. So it's not, and you'll still have in the 4D system, you'll still have n equals 4 supersymmetry. So that's, maybe I should just write down the kind of the, okay. So you can write down, say, the bosonic commutators in the presence of this guy, and you can also write down.
Sorry, maybe you can also tell us what is the gravity theory you're going to get? How many supersymmetries?
It's going to be n equals 4 supergravity. It's not going to be, well, I have some thoughts about whether it's actually n equals 8, but I don't think it is. It looks like it's n equals 4 supergravity. In particular, what we're going to see is that the plus helicity and minus helicity gravitons kind of live in their own n equals 4 multiple. And they're going to be treated differently from the perspective of the matrix model computation.
But are you thinking of this theory as a complete theory by itself, this n equals 4 coupled to gravity, or you'll be completed by embedding it somewhere else?
Or? Okay, good. So one answer to your question would have been, I started with this holomorphic Trin-Simons theory, so that provides you with kind of a completion. But I view that as kind of a fishy answer because there's no real restriction on the number of colors that come from that holomorphic Trin-Simon. Whereas if we imagine trying to compactify the usual string theory, we would have said there should be some limit to the number of colors. So there is a candidate UV completion. So the short answer to your question is no, it's not. I don't think that the matrix model by itself is UV complete. It's only going to capture some pieces of the So there is a candidate for what the further UV completion would be for an embedding inside of the superstring. But it's more speculative.
Are you familiar?
Yes, I'll keep deferring everything until the last few minutes. Everything will pile up. So if I have time, I'll try to say some words about what we think a candidate UV completion would be in the physical superstring. Okay, so here is our algebra. And if we just use these oscillators, we can represent a finite dimensional representation of SL4C. And if we include the flammionic directions, and the basic representation is you take a matrix of this, and you can represent it in terms of oscillators. Okay, so that's at the level of the algebra. So what happens in the presence of the flux is that the geometry now becomes a non-commutative. And what this means is that all of the fields of our system are now going to be fields on this non-commutative geometry. So in order to study this, what we need to do is find, in usual way one studies a non-commutative geometry is one tries to cook up representations of the function algebra as a way of getting a handle on what replaces the usual commutative notion of, say, a point. So we can do a similar thing here. So we start with commutative points. Those get mapped now to, I'll call them states, I'll call them phi, in a representation. So I'm just going to work bosonically. There's an easy extension to the to the case with supersymmetry. And it's given by the n-fold symmetric product on SL. So in other words, it's basically you introduce a vacuum state, and you can construct a representation of this guy. So that's kind of the thing that replaces a point in the non-commutative setting. Instead, work in terms of a representation of the function algebra. So what's a function? That's a matrix. Matrix. And you can write it as a power series expansion, basically in the oscillators Z and Z dagger that we wrote down before. So we can write down a power series in Z and Z bar, and place it by basically a matrix. So this is a shorthand here. Any of these could be Z1, Z2, Z3, and Z4. Sorry,
yeah, what is the big N for this?
What is the what?
N, yes.
Oh, that's the number of flux units you're switching on. So, so you imagine you switch on an, some background flux on the CP3/4. Mm-hmm. That N is the same N as this one. So you switch on some choice of background flux in this theory, mm-hmm. and then you'll have an n-fold symmetric flux.
What about the dilation symmetry you have?
Yeah, so that's going to be broken by the system, and we're only going to recover it in the strict n goes to infinity limit. So in other words, it's going to be broken at finite n. So I should say that's a big difference from the way people were imagining the usual twister string program, which tried to retain conformal symmetry on CP3/4 and then supplement it by ingredients that were going to be conformally invariant. So that's one difference from what we're doing. Okay. So you take a point, you make it into a state. You take a function, you turn it into a matrix. And you can do more complicated things like differential forms, sections of line bundles. All those things have matrix analogs. Basically, the way you do it in the matrix analog is that you just make a square matrix rectangular. And that's usually enough to encode the extra geometry. OK. So we had this CP3 picture. I'll draw it again here. So if we just do a quick count of the number of matrices we can, for example, write down, how many are there? There's roughly n cubed ways to form a homogeneous polynomial out of just the z daggers. And there's roughly n cubed ways to form one out of just the z's. Or more precisely, in the bosonic case, it's roughly n cubed over 6. And in the supersymmetric case, you just multiply this by 16. You can view these functions. Can you guys see this? What I'm here? Okay. So the way you can view these functions, I'm just drawing the same picture as before. So over each point of the S4, we have a CP1. And once you switch on this flux through the holomorphic Trent-Simon system, what you have is basically a cutoff on the representations in SO5 for the S4 and a cutoff on the representations of SO3 for the CP1. So one way of splitting up the counting of matrices is this is giving you n to the sixth, you know, that number. Scaling is n to the sixth. And that can be split up as n to the fourth functions on the fourth sphere.
Sorry, yeah. I think I'm totally lost and I will not understand anything. So
okay,
what is, can you explain a bit better this math, these arrows, for example, these points go to states, and what is this?
I'm going to explain how to make that correspondence more precise. So the idea is basically you can take a holomorphic point. It's described by some holomorphic equations inside the CP3. Those holomorphic equations are going to become annihilator conditions for states inside of this space. So I'll explain in a second how to map a holomorphic object to a state here. So I'm actually going to do that in one turn of the page. So if you have a question after that. Okay, so you can split up the space states like that. Okay. And then I should say that there's a minimal kind of, once you've put in this angular momentum cutoff on the four sphere, there's a minimal size you can resolve for the system, which is the minimal volume is what I'll call a Planck scale. And that scales like that. And it's dictated basically by the n counting one does here. So one gets a relation like alpha. OK, so now let me return to the question that was just asked about what I mean by this point. oops. You all know what the proposal is, so I won't keep it. So the point is that we're going to try and preserve some kind of holomorphic, some notion of holomorphic geometry. So the idea is that there's the rough idea is that we take a CP3, and inside of it we can define a subspace, a holomorphic subspace, by an equation like f of z equals 0. Now we write down our Hilbert space Hn, and we can write down states phi. So states phi in this linear space, which are annihilated by that linear equation. Okay, so that provides us with a notion of holomorphic subspace inside of the CP3. What kind of holomorphic subspace is it? It's a divisor. It has a complex dimension 2, because it's defined by just one linear equation. We can go further. And you can define the analog of what you mean by a holomorphic curve in the same space. So if I give you, say, two of these equations, that, as you might imagine, maps to a condition on the state.
Sorry, before I go on, and what's that feature with the rectangular table?
This is the n-fold symmetric product on the SU4 representation. So in other words,
where does it come about there?
It's coming about because we're looking at representations of all possible ways of writing down basically power series involving n degree n things in the z daggers. So if I ask you what the dimension of the representation built from n of the z daggers is, it's described by this this Young tableau. So the idea is we're trying to.
So a state is the sum of those Hilbert spaces, right? The total Hilbert space is the total sum of those Hn, right?
That's the Fock space.
That's the total Fock space.
Yeah, that's the total Fock space. And now what I'm doing is I'm working at level n to describe. Okay. That's right. Good. So then we can write the analog of this annihilator condition. Okay, now why is this an important thing? We're preserving holomorphy, and this is one of the main things that a twister theorist will insist upon if you want to describe anything to do with 4D physics. But we're retaining the holomorphy, and there's two particular choices of F1 and F2, which are particularly nice to keep in mind when we're talking about this non-commutative twister space. Those are these equations that we wrote down earlier, which linked subspaces inside of the CP3 to points of the spacetime. So these are two equations because A dot is a free uncontracted index. A dot can be 1 or 2. This corresponds to annihilator conditions.
Should I think of this phi as the result of some functional integration? This phi, what's the physical meaning? This phi has some path integral with these constraints, and this is this. What is this phi? What's the physical meaning of phi?
Phi for me is just a vector in this representation space.
That's physically, what do you mean?
Well, what we're doing is we're trying to look for a way of representing functions which can act on the vector space.
Yes, but physically, what does it mean? Is it, should I think that I'm doing some studying this holomorphic transignment and I do what? And I impose some constraints?
Oh, I understand what you're asking. This can be thought of as kind of a cell inside of the, so we imagine, okay, this is kind of a heuristic picture, but the idea is that you imagine switching on your magnetic field and you ask, where can the string end? So we partition up the CP3 into n cubed over 6 cells, and we ask which of those cells can the string end in. So that's what this point corresponds to. Exactly. And
so functional of the configuration of the string.
Right. And then what's happening is that when we have two string ends, we're describing a matrix or a map between these cells and these cells, which is why a function is a matrix, which is built out of basically mapping one of these points, a map from Hn to Hn. Okay. So you can define an analogous set like this, and this corresponds to, it defines for us a fuzzy CP1, or a non-commutative CP1. CP1. And the choice of CP1 is labeled by the point x in the space. OK, so now we can also see a hint of the same pixelization here, this Planck point, coming in how we compute the overlap of different states. So you can compute, let me call these, so there's a collection of states here. Let me call them x. Doesn't matter which one I pick for this discussion. We'll compute the overlap of x with y. And it's given by basically a Gaussian. So if x and y are different, then there's a Gaussian fall off in the possible overlap. And the width of that Gaussian is set by the same PL that we wrote down there, L Planck. OK.
This follows from what? This is your list. This is
the what? The
this
overlap?
Follows from what? From what? The equation that you wrote follows from something, or
The omega minus ix pi, or what?
No, the propagator between x and y.
Oh, that's just a computation. So you take states
just from the oscillator.
It just follows from the oscillators. Yeah. So the Gaussian is actually more precisely computed by a Wigner-D matrix between an SU2 inside of SO5. And what you're doing is you're computing that Wigner-D matrix element, which has an exponential suppression as you move x and y apart from each other.
Don't you need three conditions to specify a state?
Yeah, that's right. But what I'm saying is that it doesn't actually matter for this this part of the discussion. So you can take a further point inside of that CP1. And for any of those points on that CP1, you can compute the same type of overlap, and you'll always get this exponential suppression.
But there will be an extra factor.
That's right. Yes, there will be an extra factor. You're right. Where am I?
I couldn't understand. What was just that?
So the statement was, or the question was about, if you take a state, all I told you was about how to define a CP1. If I really want a point, I have to give you one more linear relation in order to develop. But then the question is, okay, what happens to the overlap computation when you include that extra condition? And the statement is that you still have the exponential suppression, but there can be an extra Wigner-D matrix coming from the piece of the CP1 and how that aligns. Okay. Maybe I'll stop fooling around with moving these boards up and down.
What is a Wigner-D matrix?
It's just a fancy way of saying you want to compute. If you have like two coherent basis of states, you want to just compute the overlap between those states. So it's kind of a contentless statement. I just said here's an overlap, and now I just told you a fancy way to say what that overlap is. But in the case of SU2, people have already computed all these things to great accuracy. So we can just borrow their answer.
Sir, does F of Z determine S4? Any basis S4?
Ah, OK, good. Actually, the S4 does not exist as a 4 cycle inside of the CP3.
Uh-huh.
This F of Z would describe, for example, a CP2 inside of the CP3.
Okay.
Or if we take a more complicated example, some higher degree. Complex surface.
So what? Sorry, I lost that. What's F1 and F2?
Oh, that's two. Two divisor equations.
Okay.
And that gives you some curve inside the CP. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe I'll skip some of it. The only thing I wanted to say here is that you can also define position operators to kind of supplement your description of what the space-time looks like. And these guys act on matrices in the following way. D alpha, m, d beta. And what you can do is you can write down an analog of the annihilator equation and speak of a matrix sitting at a point x. It satisfies basically a condition like x alpha beta composed with m equals x12 times, so if I now replace this by A and A dot, some 2, where this X is a C number and this is still an operator. So one can speak of, in other words, a matrix located at a position X. The main point I'm trying to get across here is that even though we switched on a flux and we made the Switzer space non-commutative, the holomorphic geometry is being retained. And as a result of retaining the holomorphic geometry, there still is a link to an ordinary commutative spacetime with some sort of non-locality, of course, built in from this overlap in the X and Y. OK, so now that I've chewed up a lot of time telling you about just the what the effects of the flux are, let me tell you what the matrix model is and how to think about it. So what are the matrix model? It consists of basically having two types of fields, which I'll call a bulk field and a defect field.
Well, let me just summarize that. Is it correct to say the following? So what we did so far is you have holomorphic transignments, you try to do canonical quantization with a flux, and these are the commutation relations and so on. This is what we have been explaining.
Correct. Okay. Yes, and then we can also write down functions, which are matrices. Right, and now what I want to do is I have those functions, I want to build a matrix model in that system. Okay, so what are the modes of the system? They're going to be different types of bulk and defect modes. And the bulk modes are to be thought of as basically things that propagate or move along the entire CP3. And the defect modes, which I'll call Q and Q tilde, Q for quark, propagate just along the CP1 direction. So I'll call the bulk mode D alpha. And I'll call the defect modes Q tilde and Q. The alpha is going to be in the adjoint of UNC. And Q tilde and Q are respectively in the antifundamental and fundamental of NC. So in other words, we equip these guys with a color index. And under a gauge transformation, they will go as follows. And for example, Q will go to E to the H. OK. And you can do the same thing for the Q tilde. OK. OK, so now that's just at the level of a color theory.
But what is this? This is a new object that appeared?
So these, you mean these Qs and Ds?
Yeah, what's the relation to the previous story?
Right. So what's happening is that what we're doing is we're expanding the holomorphic transignments theory around this flux. So we'll have the bulk fields left over from kind of the diagonal UN. Those are the analog of these. So they're to be thought of as basically the gauge fields coming from the holomorphic transignments. But then just as we have in many examples in string theory, you switch on a flux and you get extra degrees of freedom going between, say, the original bulk brain and then some defect brains. There'll be extra modes, which I'm calling these Q tildes, which are induced from being in the presence of this flux. And so our task is to basically work out what the low energy theory is for that system. So now I'm just telling you what the mode content is. OK. So this is a UNC. And in fact, you can supplement it by UNC times U1. I'll get to that in a second, why you have to include this U1. But the symmetries of the system are already doing something a little bit weird from the perspective of the commutative theory. And this is where it looks like a gravitational sector starts to come into play. The reason something weird is going on from the perspective of the commutative geometry is that this UNC is not as innocent as it looks. This H here is a polynomial in the Z daggers and Zs. Yeah, TA here is a generator in UNC. And so if we imagine writing this as this, what's going on? Even if I set NC equal to 1, this thing induces a shift in the coordinate for Q. In other words, it will cause a shift of the form Q goes to Z dagger plus H. In other words, it moves the positions around on the non-commutative space. OK, so that's a little bit weird. So if you work out this system, then what we're saying is actually you don't just have UNC. It really should be thought of as a fuzzy UNC. Because it's doing something else beyond just doing something local. Okay, so how is the matrix model defined? It's a sum of the two terms. It's a sum of the bulk term and of the defect term. So this term is cubic in the bulk field. So it's hopefully clear that it's the analog of the Chern-Simons type term. This term is a term which is dictating propagation along the CP1. And to indicate how this thing looks in terms of the z's and all of that, it looks like...
So you get a matrix model because the flux is so big that you only focus on the first one knowledge.
Yes? That's right, yeah.
And therefore, you just have some wave function, and only the global part of the symmetry remains. Right? What is the intuition for telling you that you should do something so drastic? Well, why did you have this idea of killing everything?
Oh, why do it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons to do it is to try and strip out the unnecessary degrees of freedom of the topological theory. So even though it's a topological theory and looks boring, it still contains a lot of smooth, continuous information. So one of the things that's been rather fruitful in other areas of string theory, for example, is to look at various decoupling limits. And the decoupling limit is usually defined by like a zero slope limit of some type. And one way of setting up a zero slope limit, for example, a la Seiberg-Witten, is to imagine switching on a big background flux. So that's kind of one reason to be thinking along those lines. And indeed, what we're finding is that in the zero slope limit, there looks like there's something interesting happening.
So bulk mode is the propagation to CP1?
The bulk mode propagates over all of CP3.
Okay.
But the defect mode, the defect mode, the Qs, as I'm about to explain, propagate only over the CP1s. So they only propagate over the CP1 fibers of the geometry. Okay, so how do they do this? So here, this I alpha beta is just some constant 4x4 matrix, which is dictated by the symmetries of the force. So this term, in other words, explicitly breaks breaks the SL4 to SO5. Okay. So now, what is this? So this d tilde, this script d, is related to this d, basically. Script d is d with some extra fanciness added by supersymmetry. It's not really relevant for my discussion here, so I'm just going to skip how that guy is defined. But it's defined in basically the way you might think. Now, the remarkable thing about this derivative operator is that it commutes with all the position operators we had here. So if I put an x hat on all these guys for a second, it commutes with these guys. So it's a sense in which it preserves a notion of locality on the four spacetime direction. It also commutes with the adjoint action on SO5. Okay. Okay, so now what I've told you about so far is just here's the defect operator. It propagates along the CP1, and you have the matrix model modes, which would be thought of as the fuzzy version of holomorphic transcend, some cubic action. What else can I tell you? The defect mode and the bulk mode are actually coupled. So you can enlarge this to a covariant derivative. And if you want, you can also make the you can also gauge the left action as well. And this couples the bulk mode to the defect mode. Sorry, the defect mode to the bulk. Okay. So now if we look at the gauge symmetries for the system, gauge symmetry is being defined by basically transformations like this. What one can work out is that the gauge symmetry contains something.
Sorry, the reason you said that this transformation of Q even for U1 tells you that there is gravity is because you're thinking about this as a deformation of the complex structure or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, so there's a notion of it's basically there's a general linear map on this HN, which is being described by one of these H's. And so it really is looking like a diffeomorphism, but a holomorphic the homomorphism on the geometry. So.
But it's not that you're thinking that this is deforming the complex structure of the.
Right. So it's not. I understand why you're asking this because that's the picture that.
Well, but it looks like that. I mean, somehow. I mean, if you want to still pretend that the first argument should be the dagger of the second one.
That's right.
Deforming it. Like,
that's right. So that actually leads me into the other point, which is that the role of this A tilde. Because from the perspective of the space-time theory, doing just this thing on the half of these guys, but not on the other half, looks a little bit funny. And the reason is that, that's what you do to the Qs, but to the Q tildes you do the opposite. You would just change the because of their placement inside of the derivative here. So there's another question which you can ask, which is that. If I started with a UNC system, it sounds like the U1 is playing some privileged role. So do I get a UNC theory out? Do I get an SUNC theory out? Or what's happening with the overall U1? Because it seems to be getting tangled up with these kind of funny-looking maps. So the answer to, or the resolution of this, is to basically, in order to disentangle it, you have to gauge the other half of this guy. So basically, the gauge symmetry becomes fuzzy UNC times U1 times these two GLs. So a GL acting from the left on the Qs and from the right on the Qs. So I'll just call that GL left and GL right. And the ones you identify with diffeomorphisms on the spacetime correspond to sitting in the, or the claim is that you can identify them roughly with the diagonal guys, which would shift simultaneously. So why is that the correct thing to do? Those are the ones that basically act as a compensator or a screening effect on changing the holomorphic versus anti-holomorphic piece, or the left versus the right. And what it amounts to is to requiring that this omega also transforms. Okay.
What is H?
This H?
No, the small h.
The small h. That's my choice of a gauge parameter. Exactly. Yeah. And it has some position dependence. And then what we're finding is that the position dependence is a little bit more subtle than in the usual commutative gauge theory. Okay. Let's see. How much time do I have? Okay. Let's see, so what should I talk about next? I'll tell you about, okay, I really do want to get to how you do the amplitude calculation. I'm probably going to just have to sketch it and tell you, and refer you to the paper for details. So before I do that, though, I have to tell you about how you even get close to talking about things like amplitudes. And that requires you to take, of course, a large n limit. So when you take this large n limit, what you can show is after doing some more steps, which I'm going to skip, so this is a continuum theory on. So what's happening here in this large n limit? This term is coming about just from the cubic term, the first term up there. one can check that in the large n limit that this is basically the dominant contribution, and the other pieces are 1 over n suppressed. So that gives you the holomorphic Trin-Simons piece back. But you get something else from integrating out the q tilde and q modes. What do you get? You basically get a functional determinant of the propagator along the CP1 direction. So once you do that, you get effectively the log of the determinant of this thing. And this is actually quite remarkable, because this is the form of n equals 4 super Yang Mills that Bowles, Mason, and Skinner have been writing down. Oh, I should say that I've dropped something important. I've dropped the order effect involving this Planck. So in a limit where you shut this off, you're just left with these two terms in the effective action on the CP3/4. And what was found by these guys is that one could use this as a machine for computing amplitudes, basically, in the n equals 4 supernal state, not coupled to gravity. And I should say, should also say that this is closely related to the form of the effective action that Witten was writing down for his twister string theory, which was slightly different. So in Witten's theory, what he had is instead of having this log of the determinant, which is what we get from integrating out defect modes, he was instead getting this. And the reason he was getting this is because of the way he was imagining, taking the holomorphic Trin-Simons theory and supplementing it by a sum over the instantons. When that's done, you don't get quite this term. And what you find is that you don't get just n equals 4 superangles. You get n equals 4 superangles coupled to conformal gravity coming through a closed string sector. So what these guys found is that you could write down an effective action. I think they call it a phenomenological action in the sense that it's just some consistent set of rules to get the right answer for amplitude.
Sorry. I'm a bit lost about the notations. Could you specify, you have three regions, right? UV, matrix model, and IR.
Yes.
What is the path integral measure in each case? What do you integrate over? What are the fields? So in the first case, it's a connection which depends on Z.
Yes.
What is the second case, the matrix model?
In the matrix model case, what you'll be integrating over is you'll be integrating over the coefficients of these expansion parameters. So you'll take all the matrices, you'll expand them out in this FNM, Z dagger M, Zn, and then you'll be instructed to integrate over all of the DFNMs.
And the Qs and the Ds are functions of the FNM?
That's correct. Oh, no, the Qs and the Ds are expansions of the Z daggers and Zs. And so you can write a Q, for example, as QNM, Z dagger M, Zm.
And you integrate over the Qs?
You integrate over the Q and Ms.
So you decompose everything in models.
Right.
And in the last case, when you go to the infrared.
Here we're back to a system where we describe it in terms of holomorphic Trin-Simons theory, space of connections valued in the adjoint of the UNC. Uh-huh. And we have this extra term. And this term is being treated indeed more formally. You basically set up a D-bar system over each CP1. You imagine the bulk gauge field of the CP3 is coupled to that CP1. You compute a functional determinant in the background of that bulk gauge field. So you should really write this as.
And the starting point was just the first term, right?
That's right, but it was a term with a bigger gauge group and with flux switched on.
Ah, of course.
So the point is that we switched on the flux and then we got some defects out. So for example, take like a D3 brain, switch on some flux, you won't just have the D3 brain anymore, you'll also have D3 brain plus instantons.
You also mentioned that in the limit you take L Planck to zero, but in the matrix model, where is L? The matrix model depends only on N so far.
I hit it here. I scaled it out of the problem, but it's.
So the action depends on N.
There's a 1 over L sitting everywhere. So this is the way that twister theorists often introduce a choice of a conformal symmetry breaking into the system. They will specify some tensor like this, and it will depend explicitly on a reference scale, which goes like 1 over L. So that's where the 1 over L is sitting in the.
So only in the definition of D.
That's right. This is the only term in the system which is breaking conformal symmetry. Okay. Okay. So, can I ask for 5 minutes? Okay. All right. So, the last thing I want to do is tell you how to compute something with amplitudes. So, hopefully. You know, we've seen some rough indications. For example, take the large end limit, you get an effective action which looks like the n equals 4 action that Bowles, Mason, and Skinner were writing down. That's already quite remarkable. The next thing we want to do is actually directly check that correlators of the matrix model will correctly reproduce quantities of the 4D theory. So here I have to be a little bit careful because I'm talking about the Euclidean theory, And if I'm in the Euclidean theory, then if I want to talk about massless state scattering, I can't really do it because the condition p squared equals 0 just forces p to equal 0 in Euclidean signature. But what I'm going to do is a common tactic employed by the context of amplitudes, which is to work in terms of a complex momentum. And I can still just ask what the matrix model correlator looks like for those guys. So we're going to write down a...
You think about amplitude, so far there's no gravity nowhere. Right? So where is the gravity now?
So we saw an indication of the gravity coming from the GL case, from this GL action. Now what I did is I took a particular limit where I, to talk about n equals 4, I took a limit where I just shut off that piece mm-hmm. by taking a particular scaling limit. So for example, you can take L over root n, and you can send n to infinity, but keep L fixed. And this will shut off the effects of L Planck. So in other words, this would be a limit where L Planck is sent to 0.
But then, okay, what is the evidence that you get gravity there?
Right, so at this point, it's just based on some heuristic symmetry considerations. The real evidence at this point is that we can compute now a correlator in the matrix model and check that the amplitude of that, the corresponding graviton scattering amplitude agrees with that matrix model correlator. And the amplitude is being built from currents constructed from these GLs. So there's a symmetry generator associated with the GL. We can construct a bilinear in the Qs. Correlator of the bilinear in the Qs gives us then the gravity amplitude. So that's the evidence we have that we're describing something to do with gravity, that you can compute a correlator and get the right answer.
The metric is a bilinear. The metric is somehow an operator for the 2 or 4 in the Qs. Is that the correspondence like that?
So what's happening with the metric is that you're really not describing the metric directly. What you're describing is the positive and the negative felicity modes of the graviton expanded around the R4 background. That seems to be what's going on at this point. I should say that, of course, the gravity story is more interesting, but it's also not completely clear in my head. So the best I can do right now is just tell you that symmetries match and also that we can compute a correlator to get something that...
So you compare with scattering amplitudes of 4 of conformance supergravity, n equals 4 conformance supergravity.
No, of 4D Einstein supergravity.
Einstein supergravity?
Yes. In fact, the graviton amplitude that I'm going to be talking about vanishes in conformal gravity. So, that's right. So that's part of the idea, that this is one of the issues that plagued the twister string initially. You got this conformal gravity. It wasn't clear how to even decouple the thing. Here we have a regime where we can decouple it, so it's clearly doing something different from the usual conformal gravity case. So, and then as another check, what we're doing is we're looking at MHV graviton scale. So how do you set up amplitudes? I'm going to go very fast. So this is basically just enforcing the condition that the determinant of this matrix is equal to 0. You can write down an outer product of two vectors like that. Maybe what I'll do is I'll just skip to the graviton amplitude calculation, even though it's going to be harder for you guys to follow. So what you can do is you can write down basically a coupling between the bulk mode and a current. In the matrix model. So in other words, we're going to be looking for things that we can use as external sources to set up at infinity to then scatter in. So what's the bulk current coupling? Well, it's coming straight from here. These kind of guys. So the current, in other words, is being built as a bilinear out of the Q and then Q tildes. So if we're talking about, say, gluon scattering, then we can view this really, the gluon is basically the quark anti-quark pair. And if we're talking about gravitons, well, I have less intuition for what that means, but it's still a bilinear in terms of the quarks. So we can write down a vertex operator constructed from these kinds of Qs. And one specifies it with respect to a reference momentum P as here this V of P satisfies, we'll call this the P operator. So in other words, you can write down what the momentum operator is from the oscillators, and we can write demand that we have a function g of p like this. Okay, so for gluons, what you do is you write down basically something that just involves the UNC piece. It's some generator involving these guys. Okay, now what you do to compute the amplitude, so I'm just going to be talking about MHV scattering throughout. It's basically the same computation that Nair was doing back in 1988 and Witten was doing in 2003 for these twister string and related computations. The form of it boils down to a correlator in this, basically the defect system associated to the CP1 propagating. And the basic thing we need to know is that if we take B of lambda 1 and C of lambda 2, then the Witt contraction between them is propagating. Looks like this. And this is the basic building block one uses in these MHV amplitudes. So we can also do the same thing in this Gaussian matrix model. It's Gaussian, so it's possible to really evaluate the correlators exactly. And you can compute what the form of the MHV amplitude is. And okay, I wouldn't be talking about this if it didn't come out correctly. It's the same as one has in the as in the gauge theory case. So the currents are being built from these bilinears and Qs. One basically forms a bunch of contractions between the Bs and the Cs, and you get out factors like this between the different momenta. And one gets this kind of thing. Okay, now how about gravity?
Is there 1 over n corrections?
Yes, there are 1 over n corrections of two types. There's the number of colors correction, and then there's the number of bits of the CP3. Both types of corrections are in principle computable, although we didn't do that in this paper. But yeah, they're both there. How does MHV graviton scattering work? So for graviton scattering, you follow the same type of logic. We have this fuzzy gauge field associated with the bulky one. We want to know how it couples to the Qs and compute the corresponding correlator associated with those currents. So what do the generators look like in that case? you can write them down in terms of generators like this. So here you have to specify a polarization tensor, which is specified by whether one's talking about the plus helicity graviton supermultiplet or the minus helicity graviton supermultiplet. Make sure I'm using the same notation to do that. Yes. In the case of MHV gluon scattering, one takes one of these VPs, which is specified by some momentum, and multiplies by the symmetry generator UNC. In this case, what we're doing is we're taking the most holomorphic element of GLK that we can write, GLH that we can write down, and using that as the symmetry generator to look at. This is, in other words, the analog of an infinitesimal or as close to holomorphic as we can make it, transformation coming from this thing. And it's going to be one that's built out of E daggers and Z. And so you can convince yourself that in this flat space limit, actually, the guy that survives is a guy that looks like a momentum generator. So you can write down analog of plus helicity and minus helicity. The reason for the commutator here is because of the fact that the GL is being embedded in the diagonal. For this case, for the minus helicity ones, one does something slightly different. And the reason for this computation is that one is imagining basically the minus helicity graviton coming into the patch associated with the scattering off of some background, and then leaving. So this is a computation that was done in some form by Mason and Skinner, although not in the way I'm presenting it. But okay, so you can now compute a string of correlators involving these guys. Basically, it involves It involves n minus 2 plus velocity guys and 2 minus velocity guys. And one now follows the same procedure that we did before with the correlators involving the BC system. One subtlety here is that the symmetry generators we're talking about are coming from this GL, which are themselves moving around things on side of the on the CP3. So we have to be more careful in how we evaluate it. But once you do that, you can extract the leading over 1 over n dependence. And what you get, I'm just going to write the final answer. Okay, it's a little bit complicated, but so be it. You get basically the same factor of that you have in the gluon case. And then you get a more complicated looking color factor coming from plus permutations. Okay, so this thing, this whole thing, is the analog of the color factor that we had in the gauge theory case. Color factor is now how we're being built out of this GLH. Okay, so I think it's kind of interesting that you can take this matrix model, compute something non-trivial in the 4D space-time, get both the gluon amplitudes and the graviton amplitudes to come out. But of course, this was just at the MHV level. What to really check that this is describing something to do with gauge theory and gravity, what we need to do is go beyond MHV and talk about non-MHV amplitudes. So we have some preliminary thoughts about how to do that, kind of borrowing the same set of tricks that Cachazzo, Svercek, and Witten were using in the continuum twister string theory, but now adapted to this matrix model. Okay, seeing as I'm already over time, I'll probably just stop there. But as you can tell, there's lots more to do. Okay, thanks.
So do you already have some result on the next sector, on the NMHV sector?
So what we can do now is we can write down the analog of the bulk propagator. So in order to do the computation, we need to follow the CSW rule, or do something like that. So we need to have some picture about, if I give you a spacetime point x here and a spacetime point y here, I need to be able to compute the analog of the propagator for a bulk gauge field going between these two CP1s. So what we can do at this point is we can compute we can compute the form of that propagator in the matrix theory. Mm-hmm. In fact, it turns out to be actually easier to compute that thing than to compute this defect propagator for kind of weird reasons. But once we have this, then we can start to try and string together NK MHV gluon amplitude. And what we're trying to do now is kind of see, just, well, we're looking in the literature about how to compute using, say, CSW-like rules for gravity. Because it's clearly geared in that kind of general direction. So that's one thing we're looking at there.
Can you go beyond 3 level? Even with staying within MHV, but going one loop, 2 loops?
In principle, yes. But to do it, you still have to know this bulk propagator. We should be able to do that computation too. So we should be able to go to higher loops.
But do you expect it to be simpler than doing the corresponding calculation in an input 4 direct?
I don't know. I mean, okay, so I should say, part of my motivation here is not to kind of like, you know, just develop a machine for computing amplitudes. I mean, it would of course be great if it did that, but part of the task too is not just to compute amplitudes, it's to have some other way of thinking about n equals 4 coupled to gravity. But I think it can be done.
Can you take a continuum limit in the same way and recover high same gravity on this space?
So we had some preliminary comments about how to do that. So how to work out the analog of the where to go.
Yeah, because I saw in the paper you have the you have the image part of the action, but not some analysis with the log cap.
Where did I put it? Okay, well, I'll just write it. So we took this large n limit. So we took that large n limit, and in some particular case, we switched off L Planck. We had the this log determinant thing coming out. But as you're asking, can you write down the analog of gravity? This can you write down the analog of this, but for the gravitational set? So there I have. I'm not as clear on exactly whether we're describing gravity, but what we can do is we can write down. We can basically just take a limit and work about a Moyal expansion of near the large n limit and work out the leading order terms. And it looks like a BF type theory. So there's a mode associated to the plus Lissity graviton, and then there is a mode associated to the minus Lissity graviton. So I'm probably screwing up some details. I need to check. But this is the kind of bulk action you can write down. And then for the defect action, you can write down a similar type of log determinant term. In fact, Mason and Skinner wrote down something like this, although I'm not sure whether they were able to check it beyond MHV or anything, or whether it even works beyond MHV. But we could kind of see indications that something like this would come out just from following the same type of procedure. But yeah, the bulk action is. It's not as clear in my head for how to do it for gravity.
So in that picture, H would be coming from some limit of the D field, or
right. So what's happening in this
higher modes of D.
Right. So this H is coming from it's coming from. How can I explain that? It's coming from taking. So the H here is to be thought of as it's roughly a one-form, it's a one-form living in the holomorphic cotangent, holomorphic tangent limit. So how do we know that this is where it's coming from? What you can do is you can start from you can indeed start from the covariant derivative for the q's acted on by this covariant derivative, and now consider a Moyal expansion of this thing. So if we imagine just working, okay, so very crudely working on C4, and we consider now expand into Moyal, expand this guy. So this guy is a 0, 1 form. A derivative of this guy is going to turn into this guy. So what happens is you expand in the Moyal product, and you'll get d bar q plus, then you write d a d q. And this guy can be viewed as living in, as it's a 0, 1 form, but if you just view this whole thing as a fluctuation, that index corresponds to this one, and that's where the graviton comes from. And you can do a similar thing. Yeah, you can do a similar thing for the dual guy who has to pair with it in order to make a kinetic term. So,
there are other questions.